Benefit Festival. Again, July 3rd through the 6th, noon to 10 p.m. each day here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
Welcome to Words and Pictures on KBOO. I'm your host, SW Conser, and we are joined today by Julia Gaffer. She is the author of the recent graphic novel Black is the Color from Fantagraphics. And we're also joined in the studio by Ellery Harvey, illustrator, musician, printer, and all-around creative soul. Welcome, Julia and Ellery.
Hi.
Hi, thanks so much for having us.
So let's talk about Black is the Color. How did this start out? This story is set in the
17th century?
Yeah, I was going to say sort of the early Age of Enlightenment.
Well, the reason that I chose to set it, you know, make it historical or whatever, it's not like a specific year that I had in mind. I had bought a book about the Golden Hind. A bunch of people had recreated the boat and sailed it around the world. So it was a book about that with photos of this boat, this ship that I thought was so beautiful. So I wanted to use these photos as reference, and that's the era when the ship is from. And also I needed it to be historical because I felt like a contemporary story with mermaids in it. It just kind of felt a little cute to me, like it's kind of whimsical, and whimsy really turns me off. But if it was historical, it seemed a little more respectable somehow. It seemed a little more dignified.
Right. Your sensibility seems a little bit gothic in some ways. I think Black is the Color perfectly encapsulates both your illustrative style and kind of your narrative style, too.
What do you mean?
There's a lot of stories that take place at night in the dark with deep, dark water. It seems like there's always that veil between the surface and under the surface that's happening in your comics.
Yeah. Oh, so you're saying like literally the title is...
Yeah. Well, yeah. The title Black is the Color. There's darkness, but not this classic place of fear and evil, but this place of unspoken desires and possibilities and subconscious leanings, that sort of thing.
Well, always in my work, there's like an interplay between the... conscious and unconscious worlds. There's the thing that is literally happening, and then there's the subtext of it. And so I'm always looking at like, where are those things crossing over? Like where is the unconscious world bleeding out into the conscious world and making things manifest that the characters are acting on but not aware of?
Mm-hmm.
And then there are, there's always symbols in the story that are usually classic symbols of the unconscious mind, underwater, nighttime, those kind of...
Very Jungian.
Yeah, oh yeah. It's very Jungian influence. My mom is a Jungian psychoanalyst, and I think that wasn't like pushed on me, but I think that it's like fundamental to the way that I interact with the world and the way that I think about things that happen to me. So yeah, that always happens. There's a lot of Jungian-influenced imagery. And the exploration of the unintentional manifestations of, like, non-integrated elements of the unconscious mind, that's always my work is dealing with that. Not even on purpose. I'm just like, oh, here's another one.
I'm trying to remember the name of this one small comic story that you did about this water spirit.
Phosphorus. It's about the swamp monster that kind of molests a little boy.
Oh, yes. And that's going
it's
back...
lighthearted reading.
It's fun stuff.
That's going sort of back pre-Jungian. That's going back to the Freudian sort of interaction between sex and death. Mm-hmm. You know, this kid is drowning, kind of an adolescent boy that's had some trauma that he's escaping, and he's gone to this lake, some family trauma perhaps. And so he just
right,
sort of immerses
himself.
Right,
because when he leaves, he's like, "F*** you, Dad."
Yeah. And as he gets into the lake... there's this question, is this dark fantasy really happening? Is it taking place in his head as he's losing oxygen? You know, what exactly is happening? But it's definitely this sort of Thanatos thing, this sex and death kind of wrapped together Freudian material that's happening in the comic.
Yeah, there's like three or four different ways that you can look at that story. But I think that one element of it is definitely that there's this, his like sexual being is not familiar to him yet. You know, you have this experience in puberty where you are having like an adult body and adult feelings, not always, but sometimes, and it kind of blindsides you and it's terrifying. I mean, I don't know about you guys, but you know, sometimes you have like erotic feelings or experiences that are associated not just with things that are overtly sexual, but things that are frightening because they trigger that same like uncertainty. You have like that sense that there's a thing in the back of your brain that you're not supposed to look at, and it's like sending signals out to that thing, and it feels frightening and incredibly compelling, you know?
It almost implies a lack of control as well.
Yeah,
that
absolutely.
You're not, that you're not necessarily in control of your body or your feelings or desires.
Yeah, yeah. And so this female creature, this kind of a anima creature, comes
almost like a succubus.
Yeah, it's similar. I did a story about a succubus also, who plays a similar but different role in that story. So this swamp monster woman comes up out of the dark water, that's a thing, and she's dragging him down over and over again, and he's trying to come up, and then she pulls him down again. She kind of forces him to have an orgasm, like, and he's like almost complicit in it, but not. Like, he fights back and then he doesn't, and he's struggling to find his footing. It's not so deep. It's a straight up puberty weirdness fantasy.
Well, I think one of the things that brings people back to your work so much is that there's also a lot of humor and fun inside your work, and like it deals with difficult subjects with a surprisingly light touch, considering what they're about. You know, you kind of delve into these really, really dark places of the human psyche, and I also like that a lot of it is very morally unclear.
You have a responsibility as a moral person to find the place in yourself where it would be possible for you to do terrible things, because it's not like that doesn't exist, and if you pretend that it doesn't exist, then it makes it all the more likely that you are doing terrible things all the time. If you're willing to give yourself the opportunity to play the role of the perpetrator or the villain, you get much better stories and you get much better written villains. You know, the adage that I go back to when I'm writing monsters is that the villain in the story, in his story, he's the hero, or she. I don't know why I'm saying he. You know, the villain has goals that they are trying to achieve. They're being inhibited by the hero. They're doing what they think is necessary to achieve what they believe is right.
Well, I mean, if you go back through all literature and mythology, you know, from Arthur and Parsifal, you know, Morgana and Merlin, up until recent young adult literature, you know, Dumbledore and Snape were the most compelling characters in the Harry Potter sphere, because they were these wounded characters who had done terribly dark things and were trying to recenter their moral compass. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that just makes a character so much richer.
Yeah, bad men who feel really sad about how bad they are. That's that's a popular narrative.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's when you judge a villain's character, it's really easy to see just all of the bad stuff they're doing. But when you begin to imagine that their behavior is the product of a lot of pain and a lot of loss, suddenly that character is much closer to who we are. And we, you know, it's not so hard to imagine ourselves stepping into that role. You know, anyone who feels loss or pain, suddenly you realize that the line between hero and villain can be crossed very, very easily, and that it happens very quickly.
Yeah, I mean, I like go around doing whatever I think is moral. Like, I give a lot of thought to it, even. I give a lot of thought to ethics in general. And I'm still aware that there are people for whom I'm the villain in their story. And there's nothing that I can do about that.
Well, one of the things that I think is really compelling in your work, I would compare you with Linda Barry, who also sees the vulnerability in male characters really well and portrays that. You have a really overarching grasp of gender. Even when you've got these kind of strong male characters, they have these deep vulnerabilities that come out really well in your work.
Thanks. I think about gender a lot as a social construct and the ways that it's performed and publicly evinced, and also the way that it, the role that it plays in a narrative. Like in stories, there are things that women are allowed to do that men are not allowed to do. There are things that men are allowed to do that women are not allowed to do. And I think a lot about especially allowing women in my stories to be guarded, to withhold information from other characters, to do things for reasons that they don't explain to anybody, to do things for selfish reasons, to lie about why they're doing it, and not to get a comeuppance for this, because usually women are not allowed to do that. They, something terrible will happen to them. Men are allowed to do that. Men have their reasons. It's fine. It's totally allowed. But it doesn't happen for women. There's an interesting thing with Black is the Color where originally when it was on Amazon, it had a tagline that was, in this graphic novella, a wicked mermaid lures a sailor to his doom. And I was really angry about this when I read it because that is explicitly not what happens in my comic. Eulalia, the mermaid, is not in any way responsible for Warren's death. The people who exiled him from the ship, they're responsible for his death. They murdered him. Eulalia shows up. She tells him she loves him. She has conversations with him. She tries to comfort him. She doesn't rescue him because she has her own life.
So she's a convenient scapegoat.
Well, when you see a woman in a story who falls in love with a man, you assume that she's going to make that the center of her world. And when she doesn't do that, it feels like she's culpable. He should be her responsibility. He's her project now. She loves him. When she doesn't do that, I think that it reads to people as if she's responsible for his death, but she's not.
You're listening to Words and Pictures on KABU. I'm your host, S.W. Konser, and we're in the studio today with Julia Gaffer. She is the author of the recently released Black is the Color and also Flesh and Bone, which is from Sparkplug Comics, a locally based publisher. And we're also joined by Ellery Harvey, who's a fellow illustrator, musician, and letterpress guy. Ellery, tell us a little bit about some of your work. You've done a lot of collaboration with Julia.
Yeah, it's been really great. I run a letterpress shop here in Southeast Portland, where we kind of focus on illustrative work. I've been on the periphery of the comic scene for a while, supporting people, and now I'm starting to, through Lamb House, my print shop, I'm starting to produce comics and really home in a focus on illustrative work around Portland, and been friends with Julia for a while, and we've been trying to put together this project. She pitched it to me probably a year and a half ago for one of the Grid Lords shows, and it was a really interesting process. Like she was in New Hampshire, I was in Portland, and she texted me and asked me if I wanted to write a soundtrack for a couple of her comics for the performance, and I have this really like long personal relationship with her work, and so it was almost like we got to step up to this next level. So I wrote a soundtrack for her comic River of Tears, and I'm reading her comic Forgiveness, and then there's also a soundtrack for a short comic called Spirit Hand, and it was a really fun process trying to take essentially what is like a static medium and punctuate it with music, which is this essentially a medium that's nothing but movement. And that's not to say that comics don't have an implied sense of movement and that there is an action, but they are static.
It's great to have an original score for these comics because my comics tend to be light on dialogue. So it's a little rough to do a reading because two people will talk to each other for a couple of panels, and then it's like silent for 20 panels.
Yeah, and it just feels like a slideshow at one point. So you have these panels that are going by, and everyone's just sitting in the crowd staring at them. And
I hate it when somebody does a reading and there's no dialogue, and they're just like, and then he picks up the cup, and he points out the window. Like, I can see it. It's fine.
Yeah, I see the cup. Thank you very much. Yeah.
So it's great to have you like filling in the aural space so that people can remain in the story.
Okay, you were mentioning letterpress, which is big in Portland. There's a lot of offset printing going on, a lot of letterpress, a lot of the old school machinery turning out posters and books and postcards and business cards. And you see the digital illustration and graphic design movement on one hand, and you see the analog trend on the other. And I don't know if this is just a regional thing or if people are really hungering for that look of materials with texture and layers and some sort of tactile quality
that,
to them.
That authenticity, ravenousness that people are feeling. You know, you want to have a thing that you feel like somebody made it with their hands.
Yeah, and I think that in itself is, it's all kind of reactionary. And we've seen it in a lot of different places in society before this. Like, you know, you had this entire time period where food became incredibly processed and really kind of disgusting and sugary. And like, you know, there was no connection to it. It came in packages. And then people naturally started wanting things that were organic and local. And that like, you know, see the same thing with the furniture you buy, where everything came from IKEA and everything was prepackaged. And now there's suddenly this whole, you know, generation of people who want to know who built their chair.
And yeah, there has to be a narrative behind it.
Yeah,
like
exactly.
Like the Portlandia where you get the bio of your chicken or whatever.
Yeah, and part of that too is that, you know, wanting to have that connection to the printed matter and to art and to, you know, it's a reaction to all of this awful stuff and all, you know, almost dehumanizing products. And now we're beginning to move back towards this like almost creative class. And that's also an interesting thing, that the sociopolitical circumstances of the creation of a new creative class has been interesting as well. You have all these really well-educated people who were promised jobs, didn't get jobs, and now they've kind of applied all of this talent and energy into essentially 40 years ago letterpress would have been like a lower class profession, and now, like, you know, you have
now
all of these
of
people
who
are, it's a prestige, yeah, exactly.
And people it, but are it's one of these back. Things like I think about this a lot with you, and I are both college educated and I think pretty smart people.
I'd like to think so.
Yeah, and we're going to be lucky if we make it to middle class, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
So we don't have that kind of security, and probably we don't expect to.
Right.
What we do have is like great taste. You know, we have access to types of culture that you can't buy.
Absolutely.
There's this whole other economy of style and an emotional intellectual experience.
It's an interesting shift that we're seeing right now. This, like, the rise of the creative class in Portland, you know?
So this is a question, it just seems obvious to ask, but yeah, there's the inevitable comparisons with Edward Gorey. You probably get that a lot.
Yeah, a little bit. I've seen that a couple of times in reviews. And I think that Edward Gorey is an artist that I was really into maybe like as a young teenager. And then I got a little older and decided that I was like too cool for it or something. I got more into fine art and felt like more illustration-y work was kind of cutesy. And then like more recently, maybe in the last 5 years or so, maybe as I've come to identify myself more as an illustrator, I go back and look at that work and I'm like, I'm very impressed by it. His typography, I love. Like, you can only do that with a pen and like a brilliant mind. Yeah, it's beautiful. Also, because I work almost entirely in black and white and pens of like only one line weight, and he is mostly the same, and he gets such a variety of textures, and even like there'll be depth created when there's like the grays will be the same level of gray, but there's contrast between the textures, so a depth is created, which is really impressive to me. And, you know, when you're rendering like a complicated thing with like a lot of different textures in it, you can kind of like run out of ideas. Like, how are you going to differentiate between like the fuzziness of the carpet and the fuzziness of the cat or whatever? Like, how do you draw these two different fuzziness textures?
And not have them kind of end up muddled in with each other.
Right. So, like, I totally go back to him and to Sendak also to see what the...
Ah, yes,
to get
Maurice
some ideas.
Sendak.
I love him. He conveys so much with just a little bit.
Ellery, like it sounds like you're drawing from the same well that Julia is, which is sort of this late 19th century romantic era where, you know, people were still dying of consumption and there was this fascination with memento mori. And,
absolutely. Oddly enough, the logo to my letterpress shop is the Vanitas, the skull.
Oh. Yeah.
So yeah, I'm kind of in the same boat. It's been really interesting kind of getting to attach myself to the mood of Julia's work, to be able to then create something from that has been a really interesting process. But yeah, it is very much like, you know, to get inspiration, I'm like listening to Chopin and that, you know. But we talked about the, you know, the kind of analog digital culture. And it's an interesting thing because the movements of music that I wrote for as the soundtrack are very, you know, they sound a lot like old Chopin, very F minor, very dark and very somber and slow. But there's also this electronic element underneath that as, you know, as death comes closer, there's that static electronic pulsing, and like it's been kind of fun juxtaposing that. And even the, you know, Julia's work, it's kind of an interesting dichotomy right there, that like it does have that very old school look, but yet it's being projected up onto a wall in a club, so it's mm-hmm. like the setting, you know, there's all kinds of interesting dichotomies in both the setting and the work itself.
Well, Gridlords, the event that you're both involved with, this is a monthly event now in Portland that combines visual art with a lot of performance elements, with music, with, I've seen filmmakers come in mm-hmm. and do work, there's movement, and well, there are other events here in town that are along the same lines. There's the regular Comics Underground mm-hmm. events, and also The Projects, which is a once a year mm-hmm. event that the Independent Publishing Resource Center puts on. Yep. So it's great to see the merging of these lively arts. So comics and illustration isn't just a visual thing anymore, but it's combining with the other lively arts. You know, part of that might be the availability of YouTube and blogs where the sort of thing can absolutely. Be combined more easily.
Yeah, mm-hmm. and it's interesting to see people trying to reconcile the differences too. You know, like I said earlier, comics, even though there is a lot of implied movement, like it is a static medium.
Oftentimes, people will comment on the pacing of my work. And in the rare event that somebody will write a negative review of my work, and rare only because people don't like to write negative reviews. Yeah. Usually the pacing is the thing that they criticize. People find my comics very slow, which is intentional. Like, I'll write a story and then go back and be like, how can I add an extra page where somebody just sits there and stares
sure.
at something?
Sure.
How can I add extra panels where nothing happens? I want to make it boring. You know, this happens in Black is the Color, where there's just like a lot of sitting around in a boat waiting to die. And I wanted that to get uncomfortable. When Allie Hankins and I performed she's a choreographer, and she and I collaborated on a performance based on Black is the Color for the projects. We talked a lot about making the audience sit with an image until it's no longer comfortable. And we tried to do that with our performance, because that's something that she thinks about with her work and I think about with my comics.
That's sometimes when the nervous laughter comes in.
Yeah, you want it to come in and then go again. You want to, making the audience uncomfortable is a laudable goal, I think. Well, I want to make myself uncomfortable, and then maybe that's an indicator that the audience will also be uncomfortable, but who can say?
So what's next? Are there any ideas for new projects?
Well, I'm always writing new stories. I'm in the process of writing one about Christian martyrs, like Roman secular games, that kind of thing. One of the things that it was inspired by is that I bought a book at a thrift store last year for $1. It's a kind of a crumbling paperback, probably from the 60s. That was by Daniel P. Mannix. Do you know who this guy is?
No.
He wrote The Fox and the Hound, but he also wrote a few books on topics like, you won't believe we're going to talk about this. Like, it's about the Hellfire Club, or it's about torture. And this one is called Those About to Die, I believe. And it's out of print and apparently sells on eBay for like $50. And it's lurid and almost entirely speculative on the subject of horrible ways that people might have been killed in Roman secular games. It has like a whole chapter describing like virgins and chiton being devoured by alligators or crocodiles. And you just,
Is this where you're getting the idea for the early Christian martyrs?
Yes. Like, well, I mean, yeah, I think that what you find when you dig around a little bit in these like Diocletian persecution hagiographies is that they're a little bit trumped up. There's like an investment in the narrative of Christians being historically persecuted.
Yeah.
That I think is, it's not entirely fictional.
A little bit of hyperbole
but
went into
it's maybe,
describing this.
Well, everybody likes to think of themselves as the underdog.
Yeah.
And they're lovely stories, not Mannix's stories. Other hagiographies
sure.
Are lovely. Anyway, I loved this book. I loved that it was kind of lurid and trashy and spurious. But you feel like you write this book because there's a part of you that wants to think about beautiful virgins being ripped apart by crocodiles. What's that about? You know what I mean?
Sure.
I mean, that's not in any historical document. Like,
sure.
You just dreamed that up and put it in a book, my friend.
Are you one of those writers who likes to start out a story without knowing what the ending's going to be?
I think so. Yeah, I think that's probably true. I think I start out with, like, you know, kind of like get all my dominoes in order and then I knock them over and see where they land. More like that. Oh, that sounds corny. But yeah, it probably is more like that. I don't start out with a plan of how it's going to end. It's important to me to not start writing a story until I get to the place where there's not an answer. Like, I don't want to write a story about something that I'm sure about. I don't want to write a polemic. What I want to write is, like, you know, the ethics riddle about, like, do you move the train car to save your kid and kill five people? Is it right for the man to steal the medicine that saves his wife's life? You know, there's no right answer to this question, and there's no good answer to the question. Either way, it's awful. No matter what choice you make, it's awful. It's thinking about the question, answering the question, reconsidering it and re-answering the question, reframing the question so that you can come up with an answer that you can live with. That's where, like, you're doing work, you're getting something interesting out of it. The question is performing a function for you. That's so much more interesting than having someone tell you what the right answer is.
Absolutely.
Well, Julia Gaffrere and Ellery Harvey, it's been fantastic to have you in the studio today. How can listeners find out more about your work? I know there's an umlaut in your name, so that's helpful.
You can Google it with or without the umlaut. My name is spelled G as in George, F as in Frank, R, O with an umlaut, R-E-R, or you can just put a regular O. My website is www.thorazos.net, T-H-O-R-A-Z-O-S. And I have a Tumblr. My Tumblr username is Duplis, D-O-O-P-L-I-S-S.
It's like a whole collection of really...
Spell
like,
that. Good yeah, luck. Yeah.
And we'll see ya.
Yeah, bye.
You can find my letterpress studio online at www.lambhousepress.net. And Julie and I have a bunch of really fun projects coming up. We've got the Gridlord stuff, which hopefully we'll be able to put online soon as well.
We're talking about publishing a comic together.
Yeah, I'm trying really hard to get Julia to come publish a comic in my book studio. So there might be some really fun limited edition work coming down the line.
Ellery makes beautiful books.
I do my best. Thank you.
Well, thanks for taking the time during your visit to Portland.
Yeah, thank you so much. This was fun.
Thanks for having us.
And you've been listening to Words and Pictures on KBOO. I'm your host, S.W. Konser. Thanks to all our listeners on the dial and on the web. You can hear an archived version of the show later on our website, kboo.fm/wordsandpictures. And please follow us on Twitter at wordsandpicture. Now stay tuned for an afternoon of music on your homegrown Portland radio station. Thank you.
The KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Hopworks Urban Brewery. Committed to creating world-class food and organic beer as sustainably as possible at their carbon-neutral eco-brew pubs. Hopworks is located Southeast 29th and Powell Boulevard, and Hopworks Bike Bar is at North Williams and Shaver. Available on draft and in bottles throughout Cascadia. Information at 503-232-HOPS or hopworksbeer.com. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from the Garden Spout, specializing in indoor gardening equipment, including horticultural lighting.